Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Spoken Heard. I'm Susan Dolby Chase, and today I'm thrilled to bring you Mr. Aaron Bradley, recently who's moved to Worcester, Massachusetts. Excuse me, got stuck in my mouth there for a second. From Denver, Colorado, and then before that from Seattle, Washington, I think. Oh, no, Portland, Oregon. That's what it was.
Yeah,
I've
lived in Seattle.
Around. You travel.
Yes, I'm a nomad. It's a thing.
Yeah. And, you know, I know that you've made a name for yourself in each one of these places. You must have friends in a lot of places, do you?
Yeah, I tend to. I think it's part of the national community of poets. But I've got like 27 hometowns at this point. So it's not a bad thing.
No, not at all. It's wonderful to have that kind of that kind of family in all those different places. Do you stay in touch with them through the internet?
Through the internet, through phone calls, and also, like, I tend to travel a lot, so I end up back in these places pretty constantly. So I'm always kind of around, if that makes sense. And
yes,
it's cool. Like, if you ever need to know where to get decent Chinese food in, like, Seattle, I can tell you. It makes me a worthwhile friend, basically. I can totally hook you up on, like, most major U.S. cities. Like, so, you know, feel free to share my phone number to everybody in internet land. So if they need to know where to get decent sushi in Phoenix, I can help.
I love that. I love that so much. So really, honestly, you've been all these places performing. Is that how you've got to know all of these people and been to all sorts of places all over the place and know where to get the best sushi in Madagascar?
at this point in my poetry life, I can say that I've been paid to yell at people in all 48 contiguous U.S. states. Like, I've now been paid to yell at people everywhere. I got North Dakota 2 years ago, and it was a massive thing. It's like collecting the entire set. It was kind of cool.
Fantastic. So I know that you were talking to me a little bit earlier about internet, and since we were talking about, you know, staying in touch with everyone in all these places through the internet, you got it's kind of an interesting thing that you wanted to talk about a bit about internet memes.
Ah, yeah. So the first poem I'm going to read, I find it really interesting that there's this whole culture going around where you basically get to live vicariously through 12 questions. Like, somebody asks, which Lord of the Rings character are you? And if you say you like coffee, evidently that makes you Gandalf, and you're allowed to be, like, adopt those things. And we don't. So that's all fun and cool until, and here comes the punch. I'm not going to give away the punch because that would be bad. So here's my first poem.
Thank you.
The title, which famous rock star who died at the age of 27 are you? A BuzzFeed quiz. Your results. We're sorry. You're not Amy Winehouse. Your hair has never looked that perfect a day in your goddamn life. And be honest. If they tried to make you go to rehab, you'd punk out. You'd say yes, yes, yes. But we're sorry. You're not Jim Morrison. You look foolish and pork product when you put on leather pants. If you tried to go on a vision quest in the Mojave, the desert would spit you out that same exact day because it has standards. And no one is ever going to call you the Lizard King, no matter how politely you ask. Seriously, stop asking. But we're sorry. You are not Janis Joplin. Your voice will never be her howl, her siren, her wail. No matter how violently you sell it to the cheapest of whiskey. You have not let them take all the little pieces of your heart yet. You still have reserves. Take solace in that. But we're sorry. You are not Otis Redding, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Richie Valens, Buddy Holly, or Jim Croce. Those people just died in plane crashes. They weren't the polite age for genius. You came to this website looking for validation of your genius. You deserve better than that, but we're sorry. You are not Jimi Hendrix. Mountains do not fear the side of your hand, no matter how closely you stand next to them. You did not have to cross an entire ocean looking for a land where your other wasn't so violently other. You did not go looking for yourself so deeply inside of you, you eventually asphyxiated on yourself. But we're sorry. You're not Biggie Smalls or Tupac Shakur. Both of them died too early to be included on this list. The world was in too big of a hurry to legally change their name to Blau and then reincarnate them as Sean Combs royalty checks. But we're sorry, you're not Dee Boone, you're not Mia Zapata, you're not Jean-Michel Basquiat, no matter how many darkened corners you paint yourself into and out of at the same exact moment, and we're sorry, you are not Kurt Cobain. You are not the punchline to every joke involving a shotgun. 20 years after your death, your friends will not be asked, so, you think he was too beautiful to live? Nah. Here are your results. Congratulations. You're you. You are the proper amount of ugly to have to keep living. You are the type of genius that still has to take out the trash. You still have to do the dishes. You are going to have to suffer the quiet indignity of aging. You are going to have to grow into the lines on your face. You are the song that keeps writing itself. No matter how out of key you think it is, we're sorry. You don't get to be the butterfly of genius trapped under the plastic casing of tragedy. You're going to have to settle for friends and acquaintances instead of worshipful mourners. If you wanted to be famous, you should have gutted yourself wonderful in a more timely manner. If you wanted us to applaud you forever, you should have hurried up and drowned in the fountain of youth. There we go.
That's wonderful. I love how you work all those ideas in so perfectly to bring you full circle from, you know, who you are and who you would like to be and why would you even want that? You know, the whole circle. Where did that come from in your life? How did you get to this poem?
Okay, there's a couple things. So one, I'm aging. I turn 40 next year, actually in August. So one of the massive things is there's a societal feeling that, and I know I was very much a part of it, waking up at like 30 and being like, oh my God, I'm a has-been. I didn't make it. I'm obviously not worth much. You know, there's that thing that if you didn't die young and tragically, then your art was obviously mediocre. It's a really interesting thing. So, also, for less comical things, I hung out in art scenes all my life, so I've known numerous people who have taken their own lives young. Just a thing. My father used to have a quote, if you own a VW bug, you tend to meet other people who own VW bugs. And that kind of explains that. So, yeah, I tended to be, I've known numerous people that were talented, wonderful people who died young. So trying to figure out how I feel about that, I feel about being, you know, an old Harry Potter being the boy who lived, and also figuring out that morbid fascination that we have. Also, weird thing, when I was doing research for the poem, finding out the age is so completely arbitrary. Did you know that Otis Redding was 26 when he died?
No, I did not.
Yeah. So evidently 26 doesn't count as part of the 27 club, weirdly, right? We don't just...
Right.
He missed it by, what, 12 months, and he's not considered... And he died in, like, the same time frame. He died in, like, 1968 or 9, I want to say. And when I figured out that Biggie and Tupac were 25 and 24, respectively, it was just, it's such an odd thing. Like, how do we quantify tragic genius? What counts as tragic genius and what just counts as bad luck? And, yeah, it's just really fascinating.
Yeah.
The host.
And tragic
There's
genius.
There's a lot of
bugs just...
that went into the piece.
No, go please.
I just said, I guess there was a lot of talk that went into that piece. Yeah, that's about it, though.
Yeah. What do you think it is about brilliant artists, genius, that makes them so tragic to begin with? I know that's a big question.
Yeah. I think part of it is the Western paradigm of the artist definitely says, like, for you to be a successful artist, you have to be absolutely crap at every other aspect of your life. You know, mm-hmm. We love our Dylan Thomases, right? But we love the story more that he, you know, I may have broken the record for the most amount of whiskeys drank in one day. You know, we tend to love those stories. I think part of that is an excuse for us not to have made it. It's like, oh, well, you know, I wasn't that destructive. Why we do it so much? I mean, it's not the same in Japan, obviously, where they have the whole, you know, you have to be a comedian and also a blacksmith. You know, you're not worth anything unless you've got two disciplines. I don't quite know what that is. I think it's the vicarious living. I think, mm-hmm. you know, it's much more interesting to listen to someone. Yeah, it's you don't have to have the tragic life. You know, somebody else is doing mm-hmm. it for you. Also, I think, mm-hmm. now that I'm thinking about it more, why those people get a little more pass is because they didn't have time to write the bad album that happens when you're 35. I mean,
right.
Mm-hmm. You know, Kurt Cobain died before he became any better. You know, Eddie Vedder lived long enough, released albums that everybody was like, that quite isn't the siren of my youth. And, you know, Eddie kind of vaguely faded into obscurity. And, you know, Kurt would never faded into obscurity because he didn't have time to.
Right.
So that might be it. But then again, I don't know. I just think about this shit.
No, I love that you think about it. It's fascinating to me, and I love that you, while it's not exactly research, you think so deeply about a topic and then can wrap something so serious into, like, this kind of comic newspaper then and send it out to an audience so that they think about it and you're not being the bossy writer telling them what to think.
Well, I think that's a really interesting thing. I think it's because I definitely got into poetry through the world of slam poetry. Little known fact, I was once one of the youngest poets in the history of the National Poetry Slam. I did my first one when I was barely 18 years old back in 1995. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, I showed up as like a little biscuit with no talent but a lot of yelling. And coming from that world, what Poetry Slam definitely did was it made you have to take into consideration an audience who wasn't particularly there for poetry, especially in Phoenix, where I came up, where, you know, we had pretty much hostile crowds, to put it really gently. And so you learn how to do poetry for people like me who need to be converted. It's the Julie Andrews, you know, a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. I think that's the deal. Oh, yeah, and when you said really, oh, yeah, the Phoenix audience is early in the day. One of the places we performed was a place called Club Congo, which doesn't exist anymore. But it was a biker bar. And I got hit in the head with a full can of Bud, like a full can of Bud.
Oh!
Yeah, hit me in the head. Of course, I grabbed it and drank it because I was underage. And so I was like, thank you. Now I don't have to, you know, I can't get kicked out for that. I didn't buy it, you know, things like that. So,
you hit me in the head. It's mine, damn it.
Yeah, I didn't break any laws. Yeah, so Phoenix, Arizona might not have been a huge poetry hotbed. I'm just going to put that out there. Although there were some excellent poets who taught me some of my favorite poets of all time are from kicking around in that town. So,
That's good. How long did you stay in Phoenix? You were like a kid in Phoenix?
I was raised in Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, you know, if I was to put a tattoo on my body of where I'm from, it would be west side of Phoenix, Arizona. Like, I'm definitely from the avenues in Phoenix. And I was there until, then I did what every liberal kid in Phoenix does, which is like, I need to get away. I need to go discover the big wide world where everybody isn't a hateful bigot. Yeah, and I've been kind of quote-unquote nomadic since, although I lived in Portland for quite a long time. I lived in Denver for quite a long time. I'm in New England because I always wanted to bite off the living in New England card. You know, I always wanted to do it. I love living in a place where politeness is optional. And, you know, Worcester works that way. So.
Well, that's fantastic. I love your sense of the world and of the, you know, coming up in the arms of the world. Even though it was Arizona, there's so much to you that is just, you know, an amalgam of places and people and time periods. And I just love that. And we're about halfway through the interview, actually a little bit more than halfway through. Could I get you to read us something else?
Yeah, let's do another poem. Okay, this is kind of, for being an autobiographical, this is kind of a signature piece, and I really love reading it at crowds, and if we're talking Spoonful of Sugar. So a Harvard medical study came out a couple years ago that said that unmedicated manic depressives are more than 500% more likely to take their own lives than remain unmedicated for a period of up to 5 years. Since that means, if left to our own devices, we're probably going to become our own executioners. Let's make each other a promise, shall we? If we decide to do it, let's at least be creative about it. Become a semi-professional freeway semi-truck matador. Organize your own home bleach taste test. Engage a grizzly bear in a staring contest. Refuse to lose until you do. Forward, drunken cobra makeout session. Treat heroin like a viable breakfast option. Little known fact, wolverines absolutely adore being juggled. I'll tell you a secret. Most of my suicide attempts have not been what you would call fully committal. Two whole bottles of NyQuil. Second story death plummet. Suspiciously loosely tied noose. I have hovered around death my entire life with the same tenacity I used to orbit the cool kids table in junior high, hoping if I just got close enough, it would welcome me in, tell me its secret, and I wouldn't feel so goddamn lonely anymore. But shit I've learned since then, like the cool kids table, death is not a mystery. It's just a place we ain't been invited to yet. I've never been to Scranton, Pennsylvania either, but I dare say it's not a mystery. I bet you death has a Walmart too. Now I get it. There are days that we're tired of clutching our endless front row tickets to the infinite parade of ugly. We're always tired of having to catch the knife by the handle. We're tired of looking into the mirror and seeing the reflection of our eventual assassin, but look at us. When have we ever been good at anything easy? Look at the scars on our knuckles and the way the veins in our necks become taut cables from the screaming and the screaming. And tell me, when has there ever been a good night we've gone gently into? It's okay if you get depressed. It just means you've been paying attention. But remember, the glass is half empty because you drank the other half. And that didn't kill you either. So come on, Trackmark Timmy. Come on, Razorblade Betty. Let's be the prettiest disemballerina still left twirling on the dance floor, because there are real mysteries out there to be solved. Like, why are whales so goddamn awesome? And why aren't members of the NRA forced to wear necklaces made out of shattered skull fragments of five-year-olds? And why are all the homeless people in San Francisco obviously vampires? They have to be. They never show up in photographs of the city, right? Real mysteries. Death has always been easy. Just ask Jesus. All you have to do is hang in there. If you want to live, you got to move a fucking rock. There we go on that one.
Wow. So there's some tie-ins to the poem that you did before about, you know, creative genius and also about, you know, dying young.
I think I might be preoccupied with that. My second book that came out on University of Hell was called The Little Big Book of Go Kill Yourself. So there might be a theme. I don't know.
Yeah, I was just going to get into that, actually. In that book, usually you go with things that are of that particular ilk, where we're talking about creative genius, or we're talking about what kind of beauty there is in death.
Yeah, I don't know if we've got it. It's so romanticized, especially for sad punk rock kids. It's just so interestingly romanticized. There's a poem in that book, The Big Book of Go Kill Yourself, where I really remember, it's called There Are Rules to Everything, and the crux of the story is my friend Felisa actually did a real suicide attempt back in the day that, you know, the scars were real, and I remember us all thinking she was more punk rock because, oh, those are real scars. You know what I'm saying? Like, there was some street cred to that, as opposed to, you know, the little cry for help. It's a weird thing. It's odd. I don't know when I became the morbid poet, but maybe I'm the morbid poet. But I find that there's, I don't know, I think life, like anything, is some of the funniest moments of my life have been some of the ones where I was closest to death, if that makes sense. There's an inherent humor to it that comes into play. But, I love how this interview turned out to be going on, like, oh, my God, I actually am incredibly morbid. Oh, no.
Well, okay, since we're talking about morbid things, you know,
yeah,
the editor for... Go ahead, please.
No, you keep going. Okay.
Okay. You've also become the editor for something called Drunk in a Midnight Choir, which isn't quite as morbid, but has also got that kind of edge to it that your other, that what we're discussing is. Tell me a little bit about that.
Drunk in a Midnight Choir is one of my favorite things. I am one of the editors along with, yes, I'm going to do the quick shout out, Todd Gleason, Amy Zimmerman, William James, Adam Tedesco, and Melissa Newman Evans. Yes, in case they listen to this, they know that I just shouted them out. It's become this freeform website. It's our first year, and we release something every day. And it's become this fun freeform thing where we've published over 300 writers at this point. And we try to do work and essays and fiction and whatever that is about artists who aren't above the world but are more embedded in it, because I find that more interesting. There's always a tendency for poets and writers to get a little highfalutin and think that they've figured out the answers, and I like that our website doesn't purport to really know anything. Our writers are people trying to figure it out. You know, are learning little lessons and trying to impart those, or, you know, learning little perspectives and trying to impart those. Because that's really, poetry, that's what it is. It's like, I haven't figured out anything, but I figured out this part. Here, listen to me. I think I got it. You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
Incremental learning. And we released our first book, which is really cool. Because it's like the shoestring thing where we just kind of figure out what we're doing as we're going. And we realized we could publish an anthology, because it's really fairly cheap to do it in this day and age, and there were so many decent writers. So, like, our first thing has, like, Hanif Willis, Abdur-Aqib, Jeremy Radin, Emily O'Neill. Like, I could just name William James. I could name, like, 1,000 cool writers who are in this thing. Yeah, and it just kind of came out because Todd Gleason is an amazing juggernaut of a man who kind of forces us to put together good work. It's really neat. So I'm really proud of it. Yay.
So Drunk in a Midnight Choir, if somebody wants to pick up the anthology, where would they go, Aaron?
They can go to drunkinamidnightchoir.com. Drunk in a Midnight Choir. It's Pick the Leonard Cohen lyric and you get there. Also, Amazon, all the things. Like, it, you can find it all over the place. It's pretty easy. But drunkinamidnightchoir.com, I would check that out just to check out the blog, which is really cool. And it'll lead you, if you're thinking about getting involved in poetry, it's a really good rabbit hole to go down. Because you can check every author and then where they're from. Because our archives are really easy to go through. And then you can see where they've submitted before, and then you just kind of pop around, and you can lose several days just chasing people down the rabbit hole.
So, nice.
At least I've done it that way. Just figuring out. Yeah, because there's a great American underground poetry scene happening right now.
Yeah.
You know, there's a little bit of a battle between slam and academia to see who's on top, but I think there's actually a middle ground that is slowly coming out on top. So we'll find out.
Mm-hmm.
And then either slam or academia will claim that they were there. So we'll figure it out.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, that's
how
the world works.
Right, it's how it's always been. There is poetry, and then there's something that is not poetry, which just kills me, but that's for a different time and place.
Well,
it is.
The best way to figure out what is poetry is see what academia is disavowing at the moment and what they'll take credit for inventing 10 years later. Because that's always been a thing that academia has done, which I find kind of charming. Although slam also, obviously, if you put, like, slam also sometimes is not poetry. It's sometimes very much, you know, speech and debate. You know, it's definitely speech and debate.
Storytelling.
So, yeah, it's all definitions. I personally think nobody knows what poetry is. Nobody knows what the canon is. Nobody knows what's good. It's part of the beauty is just coming up with your own definitions of what works for you. It's like nobody has decided what is the good genre of music, right? And if they have, we laugh them out of the room. You know, somebody who claims that, you know, metal is the only music worth listening to, we basically kind of, you know, shrug and then go talk to someone else, you know, leave them in their angry corner. So,
And I can kind of see in your biography just how the academia and slam works together. I mean, here you are, a multiple-time Pushcart Prize-nominated author and also a two-time finalist for the National Poetry Slam. You know, those kinds of things just butt up against each other, and they make, again, that beautiful middle ground that you're talking about.
Yeah, and there's a lot of us out there that... So I did this great thing at UMass Amherst, and what was interesting is the writers I was reading with, like Martina Spada, who is totally from the academic world, and then there's Reggie Gibson, who came from the slam world but has dabbled in academia, and the only people that care about those definitions are the people who care about those definitions.
Yeah.
Everything else is what you can learn from slam is how to present your work to where somebody will get taken in by it. What you learn from academia is how to really research and study and take good care in your words. Both of those have very valid lessons in play. And that's why the middle ground people tend to be, like Danez Smith, who's killing it right now.
Yeah, Danez. Hello, Danez.
Yeah, but Danez is one of those people that's doing the middle ground stuff really well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's involved in academia, but he also understands that a poem isn't brilliant unless someone else thinks it's brilliant.
Right?
Yeah. That's kind of the drill. It doesn't exist unless it hits somebody else's ears or eyes.
Yeah.
You know?
Hey, I hate to cut you off. I really do. But if we're going to make this any time near the end of the show, to have you read us out, I'm going to have to go now. I want to say thank you to Rick McIntyre, who always does some work for me behind the scenes. I want to say that next week I look forward to seeing you again at the same time and place. And ladies and gentlemen, for one last poem, here's Aaron Bradley.
Thanks so much for having me, and here's my last poem. It's called The Recently Retired Archangel Uriel Tries His Hand in Modern Psychology. So maybe what it is, kid, is that your 27 low-tiered angels knotted together. A mass of spastic fluttering in each of the 54 wings has its own trajectory. That's why you're always in the same exact place you started from, but still feel all the tremors and motion sickness. Or You're an army of left turns, and every move you make brings you back to you or. You are the newest incarnation of Whistler, and you are painting yourself into a corner, painting yourself into a corner, painting yourself or. The screaming looks good on you, kid. It brings out the colors in your cheeks, tightens the muscles in your neck, and makes you bomb drop gorgeous or. What were you expecting, you budget ape? You bag of meat, you are just a copy of a copy of a copy of an original. Why did you expect perfection? Or the suicide voice in you has always been correct. Maybe it's you're lucky and you're tuned into the whispering voice of God and the last one who leaves is a rotten egg. Or your head is an apartment filled with monsters and they've tipped over all the furniture. And every small death you deal yourself leaves one of them a corpse and that monster's unable to hurt you anymore. One day after you turn yourself into a killing floor, you will place your shaking and ragged palm to your ear and hear the pure you you always assumed lived in you. But for now, you got work to do, kid. Or you're just a machine. You were designed really poorly. It's really not your fault. Thanks so much for having me, Susan. It's been absolutely a blast.
It's been a blast to have you as well, Aaron. Have a great, great week. And everybody, I'll see you again. Until then, be kind to one another.